Blessed be the darkness, the vast expansion, the all-encompassing, all-surrounding womb of space. Blessed be the light, the penetrating point, the all-focusing, all-aligning core of creation. Blessed be the blade that divides the darkness from the light, thus generating duality, and from duality is all substance formed. The cleansing by water, the purity of salt, combining together, so merged we exalt. By the blade that separates the darkness from the light, the babe from the mother, and the world of the living from the realms beyond, I conjure this circle as a sacred place, shifting the confines of time and space, an island apart and a fortress between yesterday's sorrow and tomorrow's dream. Blessed be the vessel wherein the divided may unite. Welcome to the 8th episode of the Covening Podcast. I am your host, Lady Sitara. You can find me at covening.org and at Covening Podcast on Blue Sky. In the previous 7 episodes of the Covening Podcast, I presented many of the fundamentals of Windblown Wicca, enough for any of you to get started on creating your own covens if you want to belong to one and haven't found one near to you that resonates with you, or if you already have a coven, perhaps to enhance your own workings, or inspire or re-inspire you if you are already windblown. I've told you that I have enough material to present half-hour weekly shows for many years, and I do. But I want to shift gears a little for this episode and focus more on my own personal perspective on religion and on traditional Wicca. In the process of doing so, I will be revealing mysteries and providing you with your initiation gift. I felt like it was my assignment to get the last 7 episodes to you as quickly as possible, because after the last election in the USA, there was an eruption of solitary witches on social media, publicly posting that they wanted to join a coven, and I knew that it was my responsibility, my charge, to present what I had that could help. After I presented the first degree initiation rite, something felt unbalanced in me, and it took me a while to figure out what that was. This episode is not windblown. This time I am representing only myself. Feel free to share your own perspectives with me at covening.org. Some of you may not know that even in the 1800s, various books were available and even popular on occult topics. The 7th Book of Moses was first translated into English and published in New York in 1880, but it had already been published much earlier in its German versions. Frank Channing Haddock published his books on magnetic personality and the power of will in the USA, and his books were also quite popular. It is my personal opinion that either Gardner or his coven elders, or their coven elders, took bits and pieces of old European folk tradition and magic, adapted texts out of popular occult books of the time, as well as Mesopotamian magical rites that were translated into English and European languages in the late 1800s, and intertwined them with Rosicrucian and Freemasonic rites and ceremonial magic and Arthur Waite's collected tables of correspondences, many of which were extracted from Kabbalistic sources, to create Gardnerian Wicca. Yes, that is the same Arthur Waite Freemason who took all the credit for the tarot deck painted by Pamela Coleman Smith. Women truly are the hidden children of the goddess, as our history and contributions have been obscured by the patriarchy including Freemasonry. The initiation rite itself, which I presented in the last episode, feels more to me like Freemasonry, of which I have no knowledge, rather than witchcraft. Certainly in the old religion there were, and are, rites of passage, including shamanic inductions. But the challenge, the passwords, even the cutting in and out of circle, feel to me like they belong more to a secret society than a religion. The rites of passage in the old religion were usually tied to life changes, and it was the approaching life change or sudden life changes that necessitated the lessons that were provided by elders who had already experienced those changes. So for all people, a rite of passage would happen at puberty, menarche for girls, for example, and that is why in the Jewish religion, boys get bar mitzvahed at age 13 after completing a body of religious study. The bar mitzvah ceremony includes the bar mitzvah boy standing in front of his entire congregation and reading a passage from the Torah. The rabbi teacher usually assigns the passage in advance, giving the boy an opportunity to practice reading it. But even before that, the rabbi may also allow the boy to choose from a few different passages, picking the one that he feels most aligned with, which is frequently the shortest passage, but at least the choice is offered. Wedding ceremonies are also a rite of passage performed in front of the entire congregation. Most of the big rites of passage are performed in such a way that they are witnessed by the entire community of people who are important in that person's life, like scholarly graduations. Some rites of passage are attended by a smaller group of people, but in those cases, it is usually specifically women's rituals, such as preparation for the birth of a baby. The pregnant mother is attended by female relatives and close friends who have already given birth, who can provide either advice or assistance. Once the birth has occurred, the new child is celebrated by the whole community a few days after the birth, after the mother has recovered some of her strength and sleep. As with Wicca, a rite of passage acknowledges and celebrates a transition that has already occurred. Death is another rite of passage that calls for a smaller group of officiants in preparation. If the person dying is at the end of life through old age or illness, or if imminent death is expected, in the case of preparation for death, relatives and close friends who have had near-death experiences or who have witnessed the death of a loved one recently might attend to prepare the dying person for transition. The more public community ritual is held after the death, not only for the deceased, but also for the surviving family and friends. That is what I mean by a more organic rite of passage. The secret handshake, the special knock on the door, feel a little contrived to me. But don't get me wrong, I do believe that Gardner and his elders, old George Pickengill, or Pickeringill, or Peckergill, and the many ceremonial magicians and archaeologists and linguists and Freemasons and members of the Golden Dawn, who consorted with him or them, or took the time to read the works of Eliphas Levi and other source material, did a great service by assembling together a body of knowledge and ceremonial rites that are still useful today. I would have preferred if they had given proper attribution and acknowledgement to the women who were also involved in this endeavor, although there may have been a rationale in addition to male chauvinism that led the men to take all the credit. Until 1951, there were still witchcraft laws on the books in England, and although these men were clearly and publicly violating those laws, the English legal system, as well as the USA legal system, has always had a preference for prosecuting women, particularly for witchcraft. And women are more legally vulnerable than men because women have fewer rights. And this is still true in the USA in 2025. If the women who helped shape Wicca in the mid to late 1800s and early 1900s chose to remain anonymous, then I should not be shaming the men. But if that is the case, the shame goes to the legal system that forced the women into that position and devalued their contribution. And shame to all the men who reaped the benefits of that and did not actively work to correct that wrong. When I talk about my own religion, I am more comfortable referring to it as either witchcraft or the old religion. But the Wiccan form is useful. Without it, I have random passages of texts translated out of cuneiform with no way to piece them together. In my early childhood, I had an experience of the goddess, which I will recount at some point, but not this episode. By age 14, I was spending a lot of time in the public library with Dewey 131 and 133, immersed in the esoteric and the occult. Back then, there weren't very many useful books, and fewer still in the public library. And the ones about witchcraft were about witchcraft in Salem or witchcraft in Europe in the 1500s and 1600s. One of those books mentioned a practice of kissing a goat under his tail. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact name of the book. Back then, I wasn't keeping track, but the passage was shocking enough to me that it stuck in my head. Of course, we all know that confessions extracted under torture or threat of torture or death are unreliable. But what to my surprise should I encounter something similar in a publication from 1982 entitled Old George Pickengill and the Roots of Modern Witchcraft by Lou. I always wondered what body parts were involved in the fivefold kiss. For those of you wondering, no non-human animals were involved when I was initiated. The initiation did not go entirely as I expected, because by the time I was ready for initiation, I had read many books, and I knew that a lot of things were possible. By the time my initiation came around, I trusted my elders. One thing that would have been a line too far for me was photographs or other recordings, and I knew they were not going to do that to me. But long before that, in university, a friend of mine gave me a book that she told me she had to read for a class she took, although I was never able to find out from her what the name of the class was. The book was Mastering Witchcraft by Paul Hewson. There are better books these days, but back then in 1973, it was the right book for me at the right time. Somewhere around page 213 to 215, my brain finally recognized that I was reading a book about a goddess religion. Certainly, by page 223, when I found the invocation of the goddess who is called the Great Mother, and the charge of the goddess, at that point I knew I had two tasks before me. Somewhere in Mastering Witchcraft, Paul Hewson suggests that it might be a good idea to find out the pagan origins of your own ancestors. That was task one. And I was at a university with a well-stocked library, and there I found The Hebrew Goddess by Raphael Patai. Not my favorite book these days, but back then it was a good start and better than what I had been able to find prior to that. The second task was to find a witch's coven. I had no idea how to proceed in that task, so I stuck to the library and to books. Just as I had devoured books on feminism 3 years earlier, I now devoured all the books I could find that were available back then on witchcraft, and on the pre-Abrahamic religions and religious practices of the peoples of Mesopotamia. It wasn't until many years later, after I was an initiated witch, that I found the Hittites. More on that in another episode. Here's some ancient Mesopotamian text for the ceremonial magicians. Remember the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram? Before me Raphael, behind me Gabriel? How about this? From ancient Mesopotamia. You can actually download this one online. It is part of Luzak's Semitic Text and Translation series on page 15 of Devils and Evil Spirits of Babylonia by R.C. Thompson, originally published in 1903. Utuki Limnuti Tablet 3. This is part of an exorcism against evil spirits. I am the sorcerer priest of Ea. I am the magician of Eridu. Shamash is before me. Sin is behind me. Nergal is at my right hand. Ninib is at my left hand. It is clear that the magician of Eridu is facing east during this recitation, as Shamash, the sun god, is in front of him, and the god of the moon, Sin, is behind him. In the south, Nergal, god of the underworld, is at his right hand, and in the north, Ninib, god of war and hunting, is at his left hand. On page 310 to 311 of The Religion of Babylonia and Assyria by Morris Jastrow, published in Boston in 1898, is what I believe may have been the original inspiration for the invocation and charge of the goddess. Since Jastrow was a Jew born in Poland, and since I have last names from Poland that are similar to Jastrow in my family line, I have as much right to claim this as my traditional witch heritage as anyone, I guess. We need to keep in mind that Jastrow was translating and interpreting ancient text through his own filters and prejudices. It starts out sounding like a hymn to the goddess, but then the goddess herself responds through an officiating priest. I'm wondering if that might have been a priestess rather than a priest. But you'll need two bits of orientation. Sin, spelled like sin, S-I-N, has nothing to do with transgression. Sin is the name of the moon god who is Ishtar's father. And me, spelled like me, M-E, are tablets of destiny or fate. Think of them as the Akashic record. Here is the invocation. Quote, the worshipper speaks, O light of heaven, who arises like fire over the earth, who art fixed in the earth, thou art exalted in strength like the earth. As for thee, a just path be graciously granted to thee. When thou enterest the house of man, a hyena on the hunt for a young lamb art thou. A restless lion art thou, a destructive handmaid, the beauty of heaven. A handmaid is Ishtar, the beauty of heaven, who causes all things to emanate, O beauty of heaven. Partner to the sun, O beauty of heaven. Close quote. And immediately following it is the charge of the goddess. Here's the quote. At this point, the goddess speaks through the officiating priest, who acts as a mediator. For determining oracles, I have been established. In perfection, I have been established. For determining oracles of my father Sin, I have been established. In perfection, I have been established. For determining oracles of my brother Shamash, I have been established. In perfection, I have been established. Meh has my father Sin fixed. To determine oracles, I have been established, shining anew in heaven. For determining oracles, I have been established. In perfection, I have been established. Full of delight is my majesty. Full of delight is my supremacy. Full of delight do I as a goddess walk supreme. Ishtar, the goddess of morning, am I. Ishtar, the goddess of evening am I. I am Ishtar. To open the lock of heaven belongs to my supremacy. Heaven I could destroy. Earth I could devastate. Such is my supremacy. I could be the destroyer of heaven, the devastator of earth. Such is my supremacy. Queen of heaven, that on high and below is invoked, such is my supremacy. The mountain I sweep away altogether, such is my supremacy. The destroyer of the mountain walls am I, and their great foundations am I, such is my supremacy. Close quote. There is a third part to this text that closes with a prayer that the anger of the goddess should be appeased. On page 169 to 170, in the Religion of Babylonia and Assyria, especially in its relation to Israel, by Robert William Rogers, published in 1908, quote, "This thou shalt do, a green bough thou shalt sprinkle with pure water. Four bricks from the midst of a ruin shalt thou set up. A lamb shalt thou take. With karbatu wood shalt thou fill the censer, and thou shalt set fire to the sweet-scented woods, some apunta plant and some cypress wood. Thou shalt keep up. A drinking offering thou shalt offer, but thou shalt not bow thyself down. This incantation before the goddess Ishtar. Three times thou shalt recite, and thou shalt not look behind thee." Incantation. O exalted Ishtar, that givest light unto the four quarters of the world. Close quote. Now, instead of imagining that priests were performing those rites, imagine it was priestesses. This is also from ancient Mesopotamia. "O Ishtar, merciful goddess, I have come to visit you. I have prepared for you an offering, pure milk, a pure cake baked in ashes. I stood up for you a vessel for libations. Hear me and act favorably towards me." And this is from the book of Jeremiah and the Hebrew Old Testament, 7:18 and 44:19. "The children gather wood, the fathers kindle fire, and the women knead dough to make cakes for the Queen of Heaven." And the women added, "When we burned incense to the Queen of Heaven and poured out drink offerings to her, did not our husbands know that we were making cakes impressed with her image and pouring out drink offerings to her?" Between the 1800s and 1905, there was a surge of archaeologists, religious scholars, linguists, and anthropologists studying, translating, and interpreting newly unearthed clay tablets from ancient Mesopotamia as well as Egypt. There became available huge volumes of translations of religious and magical texts from which aspiring occult teachers could extract, reinterpret, and compose evocations, banishings, invocations, rituals, spells, and all it took was a little imagination and creativity. The basics were already there. They just needed to be organized, assembled, adapted, and with a little rewriting, do that and slap on a story about how it was all passed down from druids, and voila! Is it possible that England had druid or witch families with magical powers in their bloodline, with pagan rites and knowledge passed down in secret, unbroken, for 1,000 years? Hell no. Not any more than I am a hereditary Hittite Jewish with unbroken tradition. Do I believe that there were remnants of rites called family traditions, or folklore, or superstition, passed down unevenly in disjointed ways and differently in different families? Certainly. As for magical powers, they do not get passed down in bloodlines in any consistent way. Are there magical powers? The clairs are real. There are people who have extraordinary intuition and the ability to read other people's minds. Can those talents be cultivated? Certainly. Is every painter a Rembrandt? No. Does everyone have the same potential? No. Can everyone do a little bit of it? Sure. Everyone who studies painting can paint something. Everyone who studies music can play something. And that hereditary thing? also works like everything else. Every now and then, a great musical composer or musician is born to a family without any history of significant musical talent. And Handel's great-great-great-great-granddaughter might not be very good at playing piano. His great-granddaughter taught piano lessons. What about changing people's minds? If you can gain read access to someone's mind, can you gain write access? Can you make someone do something they would not otherwise do, or not do something they were intending to do? Yes, you can. Making someone not do something they were intending to do might be easier than getting them to do something they would not otherwise do. Here we are talking about hypnosis. Can you do it with candle magic? Sure, if you use candle magic to prepare yourself for doing hypnosis. Can you do it at a distance? Ah, now that is a good question, and I have only partial answers. Remote healing works, but it is not always dependable, and the people who do remote healing professionally say that if their target has agreed in advance to receive the remote healing and is in a receptive mode at the time the message is sent, there is a greater chance of success. There have been brainwave studies that show that the target receives the message from the sender at the exact moment that it is being sent. Certainly, there are things we are still learning about the human mind and remote communication. What about causing things to happen? If you manage to align yourself with your environment in such a way that an outcome that you desire is likely anyway, magic can help you tip the scales of probability in your favor. What about the magic we do in circle? If minds are joined in alignment and with similar maps and imaginings, and they apply the right kind of precise thrust into a working, the outcome is more likely than if the effort was only from a single source. Magic by itself cannot overcome an army. A person who relies on magical rites alone, without other types of effort to achieve their goals, is in for a lot of disappointment. Magic is enhanced when coupled with psychology and understanding the mind and consciousness. So this thing about hereditary witch families, that and $5 will get you a cup of coffee. But as I said, many families had or have some small remnants of customs or beliefs from earlier times. After all, we have eggs at Easter and Pesach and Nowruz. When I told my mother that the Sabbath cake I make for my witch circles was spiced with cumin, she responded, "Oh, like Hamantaschen?" And it hit me like a brick. It was right in front of my face all along, but I had not seen it till now. For those of you who are not Jew witches, and for those of you who are but would like a refresher anyway, Purim is a Jewish holiday that is observed at the full moon sometime around spring equinox. In 2025, it will be celebrated beginning at sunset on March 13th. The Book of Esther relates the story of a Jewish woman in Persia, Esther, who is willingly married off by her uncle Mordecai to the king Ahasuerus of Persia as one of his wives. Through her attentiveness, flattery, seduction, and feminine wiles and sexual favors to the king, Esther persuades King Ahasuerus to refrain from waging genocide against the Jewish people. The genocide of the Jewish people had been proposed to the king by the king's evil advisor, Haman. This springtime festival is celebrated with costumes, noisemakers, pageantry, rambunctious children, and a particular type of cookie or tart called Hamantaschen. I have searched for recipes for Hamantaschen, and none of them that I found included cumin. But somehow, my mother had a piece of memory passed down. Hamantaschen is a cookie that is made by rolling dough flat, cutting little circles out of that dough, and pinching three edges, approximately equidistant, so that the new shape is like a triangular volcano. And then the middle is filled with jam. This is important. This is so important. This is important because the rabbis had to make up a story about why the cookies were triangular shaped. The story they made up had to do with Haman's hat. Some scholars have suggested that this biblical story is a complete fabrication that served to Judaify and thus legitimize persistent springtime folk practices that may have originated in pagan times to celebrate the goddess Ishtar. Thus, the strong resemblance between the name Queen Esther and Ishtar, Queen of Heaven. We know a little bit about the cakes that were baked for the Queen of Heaven. They were baked outside over a campfire, or rather over hot ashes, and did not involve rising. So maybe flatbread or cookies? Some people have proposed that matzah might be the original cakes for the Queen of Heaven. But then there's that passage, cakes impressed with her image. Both the circle and the triangle have been used as sacred goddess images for thousands of years. The circle, or oval, represents the uterus, the egg, the opening of the birth canal. The triangle, particularly with the point downwards, is prominently displayed as the pubic delta on most ancient Mesopotamian images of the goddess. In other words, the pubic mound. But the triangle is also the shape of the uterus when a woman is not pregnant. One angle attaches to the right fallopian tube, one angle attaches to the left fallopian tube, and the angle that points down is the cervix, which opens into the birth canal. And so those cookies that start out as circles are pressed into triangles and then filled with something sweet and probably red or reddish, or maybe figs, or with seeds or poppy seeds, thus emphasizing the goddess in her maiden aspect with motherhood potential. Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, and I'll be adding cumin to mine. Purim is at the next full moon on March 14th, beginning on the eve of March 13th. I am putting recipes on my website, covening.org. Click on transcripts and you will find several recipes there because I know many of you have different dietary requirements. You have a few weeks to prepare, and I'll include my Ishtar rites in the podcast soon. Not only have I bestowed upon you the windblown initiation ritual, I have also presented you with the mysteries and provided you with the gift of the recipe for Sabbat Hamantaschen on covening.org. Click on transcripts. There's a chance I'll be running a little late with those recipes. If you don't see them right away, they will definitely be posted by this Friday. Thank you for joining me. Please tune in next week. Blessed be. By the blade that cleaves the darkness and light, the babe from the mother, and the world of the living from the realms beyond, I carve a tunnel to the mortal realm. As common persons, we are masked until the circle be recast. Sacred ground remain unseen. Silence rules the worlds between. Till next we answer magic's call and meet together, witches all.